Hey everybody, this is John Lobinger, host of Film Baby Film, and today I am bringing you the Best of 2017 episode. I recorded this a couple of weeks ago, but as I mentioned in a previous episode, I was lucky enough to get to travel, went to Nicaragua, and went to Sundance Film Festival, and I don't want to brag, but I just got a couple of great opportunities, so I fell a little bit behind in releasing the episode, so this may be a little bit after you've heard other people's 2017 selections, but I definitely wanted to get this out because it was a terrific conversation with my co-host, DJ Moore, who is a wonderful guy and really great person to talk to about movies. And so many movies this year that I enjoyed, even with including some of the movies that were honorable mentions in our top 10. We probably could have done top 30 lists pretty easily and still had to leave some off. So just a really great year for movies from my perspective. And I definitely want to share that with you. A couple of other things I want to share with you is that just completed our PTA two-part series yesterday. And now we're going to be uploading a conversation that I had with Jordan Esso on Phantom Thread. Also, as I'd mentioned before, coming out with a Macbeth adaptation episode any day now from FlixWise Canada with Martin Kessel. Really excited to share that with all of you. What else is coming up? Having a really terrific, I'm very excited having Becky Diana, who's one of my favorite podcasters about Ingmar Bergman, is going to be on the show. And we are going to finally get a conversation and we're going to be discussing Shame, which is a Bergman film I really, really like, shot on Föda, also known as Faro, Bergman Island out in the middle of the Baltic in Sweden, and just a really great film. And Becky is a phenomenal movie mind and podcaster, so I'm just excited to have a conversation with her, so I'm looking forward to that as well. So, yeah, good stuff coming up. More Film Baby Film, more podcasts that I get to be on and get to talk about movies, and I'm going to have some more people come on. But first, you guys got to hear what are the best movies of 2017. So without any further ado, Film Baby Film, Best of 2017 episode with DJ Moore. Let's do this. DJ, welcome back to Film Baby Film.
Thanks for having me.
How are you doing today?
Pretty good. How are you?
So for everybody listening, very excited. DJ was on a previous episode and we had such a good time. We talked afterwards and decided to do a top 10 of 2017 list. So you are joining us for a very special episode. DJ, Let's just get right into it.
Let's go for it.
This is Film Baby Film, the podcast for people who love movies or films if you're being pretentious. And we're just gonna dive right into the deep end of pretentiousness right now. Tell me, what did you think of this year's movies? What did you think of 2017's movies?
Well, I had a really tough time trying to narrow down a top 10. So for me that means that it was a pretty great year for movies. I probably could have easily done a top 20. And so it took a lot of work and kind of readjusting, recalibrating kind of that top 10 and what should go into which spot. So
I did a useless top 10.
Okay.
Like in November, cause I had already seen a lot of the prestige. I'd already seen a lot of the prestige movies that I knew were going to make my top 10. And so I did that list. And honestly, even of those movies that are still on the list, they've moved around in order of each other. And then on top of that, I did a podcast like a week or two ago, and I submitted my top three. Again, same thing. Those three are no longer in the same order. I mean, yeah, this is a year that not only had a lot of movies, but there were a lot of movies that felt like they were neck and neck in terms of quality.
Yeah,
and it really just depends on, you know, people always say like, oh, I don't like lists, or it depends on the moment you catch me at. And I always like roll my eyes, but I know from trying to do it, that is the real experience for me this year.
Yeah. Yep.
Did you catch any themes from the movies that you saw this year? Are there any big themes of the 2017 movies that we should talk about before we dive into our number 10 picks?
I think there was a lot of stuff with some strong social commentary, especially politically. I also noticed at least two movies I saw dealt, and I'm not going to say which movies because I think it could be considered spoilers, but at least two movies dealt with being poisoned by mushrooms.
Yes! So, yes! Oh, I love it.
I don't know if that's a new like sub theme or what, but just something I noticed, and both of them I watched this week. So,
I mean, true to life, though. I mean, that's basically how my life has played out this year. It's been all about politics and getting poisoned by loved ones. So, and did you see so? One of those is a theme that I had picked up on. It's really hard to. I dive deep into movies this year in part to escape from politics, but in part also to like be able to embrace and talk about and think about politics in a way that is less maddening than like social media or watching it on TV. And yeah. So movies were a way for me to cope with that. And it was important for me that the films like. That some films address it, but also important that, you know, I don't have to deal with it head on and with like the madness of 24-hour news coverage and talking heads and hot takes.
Yep.
The other one is a theme I had noticed, but didn't have, I guess I didn't have the guts to say it, the poison mushroom theme. I love it. But connected to the politics this year, horror was huge this year.
Yes, it was. And I think that'll come up in my top 10 in a couple places. So.
Same here. I think, It, because I suspect that It is not going to be on either one of our top 10. So.
Nope.
But if you think about it, it was one of the biggest hits of the year. It was 700 million domestic, almost a billion worldwide.
Yeah, I want to say it's the most successful horror movie of all time, I think.
And
I thought that's...
Yeah, and I mean, and Get Out, which is on just about everybody's top 10 list, or at least honorable mentions, that's a movie where I think the budget was like $2.5 million, $5 million. I mean, it was a small budget movie, and it went on to make, what is it, the first movie made by a black male director that made more than $100 million?
Yeah.
I mean, it was a smash hit. And on top of that, there were so many women... horror movie, like so many female-directed horror movies. I mean, this is definitely a year where horror played a big part, and there's a part of me that thinks that it probably is connected to the politics as well.
Yeah, and also just a huge year for women directors. I mean, you look at the slate of movies that was released across all genres, and it was a really strong year for female directors.
Was what, and it, you know, again, so talking about Get Out, huge movie. Directed by a black male, and then we have Wonder Woman, which is that the highest grossing movie ever directed by a woman?
Yes.
Yeah, Patty Jenkins,
yep.
Massive hit there, and she definitely there's at least one scene that I felt like was like snuck in there, that was just like it was just absolutely wonderful, and you know, poking a finger in the eye of some of the people on the right. It was just this was a year where I got really into movies to escape from some stuff, and I feel like I picked a good year to do that.
I would agree, yeah.
So now that we've talked about some of the context around the 2017 movies, let's dive into it.
All right.
DJ, what is your number 10 pick?
So number 10, and I'm going to say probably my 10 through 6, I don't know that it's really ranked. It's just kind of possibly all at the same level. So I had to like back off of the actual ranking. So number 10, I have Mother.
Oh, wow. Great. So I'm glad. Yeah. So that is not a movie that made my top 10. And that is a movie that I've seen multiple times. Aronofsky is one of my favorite directors.
Mine too.
So I'm excited to hear your take on Mother! Well, exclamation point.
I've only seen it once, and after walking out of it, I didn't even know what to make of it. I don't even think I usually do reviews on Instagram, and I don't even think I did a review for it because I knew it was a movie I just had to process for a while. And it was a movie that I found over the next couple weeks, even months, just going back to and thinking about and talking to people about whether they'd seen it or not. I've had three or four people ask me what I thought of it, should they see it, et cetera, et cetera. So when it came down to looking over all the movies I saw in 2017, that one was one I kept circling back to. And originally, in the kind of first few drafts of this, it wasn't on the list. And it really came down to, for me, Aronofsky is a director, along with the director on my number 9, who, if they release a movie, I think it automatically is going to be in my top 10 just because of their skill and what they do. And for this, it's not my favorite Aronofsky film, but I just feel he really swung for the fences on this. And the fact that it was released by a studio, the fact that it even got made and released just blows my mind. And it's something that I am looking forward to going back and seeing again. And because it just took me a while to get through all the symbolism and just the metaphor he uses throughout. And at first I thought it was kind of a little too much overlapping metaphor and it wasn't straightforward. But the more I thought about it, the more I was like, well, I think that was the intention and there's a purpose to it. So, yeah. So in the end, it just had to make the list for me.
Oh, I love it. I love it. And there were really controversial movies made this year, either like aesthetically controversial or just like controversial. And this is one of those aesthetically controversial movies.
Yep.
I didn't even put this on my honorable mentions. And before this year, Aronofsky was probably my favorite living director, or was one of my favorite living directors. This movie I saw a few times. I was very excited to see it. On the plus side, I mean, Jennifer Lawrence's performance is amazing. And then just technically, the way that the sound effects and the soundscape of the film is masterful. I mean, you're in the movie theater and you can hear, because it's from Jennifer Lawrence's perspective for most of the movie, you can hear the different things in the house from where they would be in the house in relation to Jennifer Lawrence. I thought the cinematography was amazing. I think it was shot in 16mm and then transferred. Just technically, it's a masterpiece. And that's it for me. and then that's where I stop. And I guess the other plus is that I think maybe 10 years from now, 20 years from now, when we look at Aronofsky's overall filmography, maybe this will be like one of those movies that fits into his filmography in some way. And I do. Yeah. I have to love the audacity of somebody that got to convinced other people to invest to millions this, yeah. of dollars to make this movie. But it just, the multiple times, it just didn't work for me. I never felt anything about the movie other than perhaps, a little annoyed. There's a part of me that is angry that Aronofsky made a movie about how men mistreat the women in their lives in pursuit of their creative goals. And at times, maybe I felt like it was too self-indulgent. I don't know.
It definitely is. And I should probably say that if this was a list of my 10 favorite films of the year, this wouldn't be on there.
Right. So I don't know. This is a movie where I could absolutely come back and reassess and give it a much higher review. But watching it, there was a huge section of time where I was just rolling my eyes. Whereas, you know, The Fountain and Requiem for a Dream, Black Swan, those are some of my favorite movies ever made.
Yep.
This movie, I think, is not. I don't particularly like this movie.
All right.
So.
I don't even know that I can say that I like it.
Yeah.
if talking best films of the year, I could reassess this next week and think, you know what, maybe not, but I'm sticking with it for now.
Oh no, it's totally in the conversation. I'm glad you put it on there somewhere so that we could talk about it. So my number 10 of the year, I selected Get Out. So okay. as we mentioned, 2017, definitely the year of the horror film. Do you have this anywhere? Did you select this as one of your top films? Okay.
Get Out is my number 7. So
great. And so the thing for this movie that works for me, and there are a few things that work for me, but probably the best magic trick that this movie pulls off, and it's something I've never experienced before, is that I'm sitting in the movie theater towards the end of the movie, horrified by basically the person in the movie that is me. Oh, I guess that's yep. that's not amazing. I mean, I guess I've seen that in other places, but more specifically, I felt for a second the just absolute terror and paranoia that it must feel like to be a black person in America in certain circumstances. And when I felt myself experiencing that, I was like, all right, that's impressive. And there's one mm-hmm. particular scene with some flashing lights, and I won't say anything more than that to avoid spoiling it for anybody. But man, when those flashing lights pulled up, my heart dropped. I was filled with terror. And when it finally played out, I realized, like, wow, that is an impressive magic trick by the director.
Yeah, and I've been a fan of Jordan Peele since Key and Peele started, and on the comedy side of things. So when I heard that he had written a screenplay and was going to direct, and it was in the horror genre, I was like, well, this is going to be interesting, because Key and Peele did a few skits that played off of horror, and they were really well done. So, I mean, I think he just, not only did he deliver, but above and beyond what I was expecting from it, and just the social commentary on horror, or through horror, is I think he's signed on to do a new version of The Twilight Zone.
Oh, I didn't know that.
I think I think could be a perfect matchup, because I think some of the classic episodes of The Twilight Zone did exactly what Peele accomplished with Get Out. And I was thinking, as I was making this list, I was thinking of one of my favorite Twilight Zone episodes, The Monsters Are Due on Maple Street.
Oh, right. And, absolutely.
Yeah. And I think with what he did here is a modern version of that. I mean, obviously taking it in a different direction with some of the themes, but right in line with what I think the best of The Twilight Zone accomplished.
So I also am a big fan of Polanski's 70s work, his mm-hmm. early work, and so is Jordan Peele.
Yep.
And he mentioned in a conversation that he's obsessed with Rosemary's Baby. He's also, I think the author is called Ira Levin, also wrote, I think, Stepford Wives. And so
okay.
those two movies are movies that he name-checked in terms of, he doesn't even consider Get Out a horror film. He considers a social thriller. And I saw that in the movie, and you totally get that sense, as opposed to it being like a woman's sense of paranoia, or not paranoia, perhaps justified paranoia, that the men in her life are being condescending and are mistreating her and her, you know, sort of messing with her head. That same sense of paranoia, perhaps from the black perspective, particularly in like Obama's America, where people are saying that they're post-race and all of this other stuff. I just thought that he totally captured that, and he did it on a very small budget as well.
Yeah.
I at times I felt like the reason why this isn't, I don't rank this as highly as I think some other people do, is because at times I could feel that the thinness of the budget, and I think there are enough ways to make a really high quality movie where you can avoid doing that on a small budget. And I felt like at times I was like, oh, this is, you know, some of the, it's feeling a little threadbare here. Yeah. But listening to him talk about the movie and talk about, you know, talk about, for instance, the distrust in the black community about psychology and about hypnosis and mind control and how he, this movie is imbued with that, like literally, not just the overall tone, but also the literal use of psychology and hypnosis in the film. Like, it's a really deep, really well thought out horror film that took me to a place that I'd never really been taken before by a movie. So you have to put it on a top 10 list for something like that.
Totally agree. And I just saw a friend posted on Facebook today a comparison of a shot from Guess Who's Coming to Dinner and the lunch scene from Get Out. And I guess Jordan Peele had said that Get Out wouldn't have existed without Guess Who's Coming to Dinner. And that shot was an homage to Guess Who's Coming to Dinner. And when you look at it, the interesting part for me that stood out was if you look at the seats, everyone's in the same spot except for the daughter and is it Daniel Kaku? I'm not going to say his name right.
The protagonist, the actor that plays the I can't pronounce his name either.
Yeah, they're going. Their spots are switched from Sydney Poitier and the daughter in Guess Who's Coming to Dinner.
Interesting.
Pretty cool.
So, what is your number nine, DJ?
Number nine is Phantom Thread.
Yes.
So is that on your list at all?
Number six.
Okay. So again, Paul Thomas Anderson, similar to Aronofsky, is just a director that I think even more so than Aronofsky, because I wouldn't have, Noah would be something that I wouldn't have put on really any list for Aronofsky. But I think any PTA movie I've seen would probably have made my list for that year. And this was one, I just saw this last night. So again, still kind of processing stuff, but, just so impressed with, he acted as his own cinematographer in this for the first time. And it seems like he depended on a lot of his usual team, to kind of get him through that. And I thought the cinematography was fantastic in it. And just as, which we discussed in our, I think we touched on this in our last episode, Daniel Day-Lewis's last film. Quite the performance to go out on. Not my favorite from Daniel Day-Lewis, but there's not a bad performance in his filmography. So if he's going out with this, then I'm okay with it.
So I do this. What was it? What was it? Celebrity Deathmatch? Was that the MTV show?
Yeah, MTV show, yep.
I have this celebrity death match in my head between PTA and Darren Aronofsky. And I've had it for a long time where it's always like, who's the best? And that would be like a conversation I would have with friends or people over dinner. And I think up until this year, I had Aronofsky. And then more recently, I've had them tied. But I feel like this is the year where PTA has just blown by Aronofsky, and whereas I felt like Mother was the same old punk rock song by an aging rocker, like I feel like Phantom Thread is a really deep transition, or like a subtle understated moment for PTA, and I think he pulls it off wonderfully. Daniel Day-Lewis is probably the pull for a lot of people, but for me it's actually Cyril and Alma, sister and the love interest in the film, that really pulled me to it. And as you mentioned, the poisoned mushrooms, there are poisoned mushrooms here. Phantom Thread definitely name checks a lot of classic films. The tone of it and the storyline of it feels like Rebecca, Alfred Hitchcock's Rebecca through and through. The fact that it's a woman named Alma who's cutting and cleaning mushrooms, no question, like you have to think of Bergman's Persona.
And then even some Fellini, some old Fellini films, I feel like are name checked there. So, you know, but all that's to say, I really enjoyed this movie, and this is one of my, I love Paul Thomas Anderson, one of the best living directors, and this is one of his best movies, in as far as I'm concerned.
Yep, I would agree with all of the above.
So, unless we have anything else we want to say about Phantom Thread, I'll move on to my number 9.
Go for it.
So, I picked Your Name, period. This is one of those movies that was released internationally before 2017, but I saw it here in America in the movie theater in 2017, so I'm including it.
Okay.
This is a Japanimation film that is one of the... It is the most successful, highest-grossing animation film in Japan's history. So right there, that should tell you something.
Yeah.
It is a coming-of-age story. It's like a gender body swap story. So, you know, when I first heard that, I was like, this is going to be like a bad 80s movie. And to some extent, it still had a lot of that fun of the bad 80s movie type formula. But the way that it's done, I thought, was amazing. This wonderful Japanese pop song soundtrack, beautiful visuals. But overall, the thing that really did it for me is that it weaved together lots of different great themes. There's like sad, it's a sad commentary about warfare and loss. You know, throughout this, like this yin and yang concept, the rural and the urban, the male and the female, the past and the present, and, you know, the living and the dead. And it was just a really fun, beautiful, thought-provoking film. I saw it multiple times in the movie theater. I'm going to go see it again. Museum of Fine Arts here in Boston has started its first annual Boston Film Festival of Movies from Japan, which is probably the worst named film festival of all time. But is I'm very excited to have it come. And so this movie is going to be playing there, and I'm thrilled.
I'm going to have to go check it out because I unfortunately have not seen it. But after that sell, I'm definitely going to check that out.
So what is your number 8?
Well, that actually makes a good segue into my number 8. My number 8 is actually Coco.
Yes.
So I love Pixar. I've seen pretty much, I've definitely seen everything they've done, and I've seen, I think, everything except 3 of their movies in the theater. And this one stands up there with some of their best, I think. And aside from, I really got sucked into the story and just the multiple themes that kind of all weave together. And it's family and kind of your place in your own family and memory, the afterlife, music, your legacy. And from a technical perspective, I just thought it was an amazing piece of art. There's one shot in the movie where the animators said they have over 7 million lights in one shot, which is, and it stood out. I had seen a little clip about that before I saw the movie, and the scene definitely, I mean, once you know that, you'll definitely be able to identify which scene it is. And it's just something that at the end of, I was, again, something that, a movie that I kept thinking about for weeks afterwards. And not, Pixar movies aren't usually like that with me. I see them, I enjoy them. You know, some of the scenes stick with me, but this movie as a whole was something that I kept going back to. So, again, when I sat down to make this list, it definitely, I knew it was going to have a spot on it.
That's awesome. So this is a movie that I have not seen this year. And I think overall I have a bit of a blind spot on Pixar films. And I don't know what, there are just certain movies which, to my discredit, no matter how much I know that it's probably going to be a great film, I just have a hard time going out to see them. Pixar films is one of those. Maybe it's because I'm a single middle-aged male and I go to the movies by myself a lot. And so I feel like going to a Pixar film is a little bit creepy, but I don't know.
Yeah, I feel the same way, but I still do it.
Yeah, no, that's a movie I'm excited to see. I've also been told that a lot of the Mexican families that go see it have given like really good reviews of it and said that it really spoke to their experience. So that definitely adds to my desire to see it.
Yeah, and I give Pixar and Disney a lot of credit for capturing what I assume is representative of that culture, because from what I know, it seemed to do a great job of it. And I've talked to some friends and read a lot online that the families do seem to be very happy with it and feel represented finally.
And you know, if Disney is going to be our new mythological, like American mythology overlords, it's nice to know that at least they have, at least they you know are willing to represent diverse perspectives.
Yes.
So they're still our overlords. It's still creepy, but yep. At least they're putting out some good movies from different perspectives. So that's good.
Yeah.
So my number eight is The Post, directed by Steven Spielberg. And this is a movie that I in no way, shape, or form thought that I was going to put in my top 10.
Well, it's my number two, so.
I mean, going into it, I was just like, oh, another Spielberg civics lesson movie. And you and I joked, I think you and I did joke about this on a previous podcast, where it's like, this is the third in his trilogy of civics lessons, starting with yep. Lincoln and then with Bridge of Spies. It's like, oh, whatever. But then when I went to go see it, I think that in terms of politics, one of the things that makes me sad is the death of old media. This year, I went to go see a movie that is going to be on my top 10, so I'm not going to name it. But I went to go see this great movie at the end of August, and the movie theater was empty. And this was this terrific adult like film. It's like high quality. It's the type of stuff that people say like, oh, nobody goes to see movies anymore because there aren't any good movies out. And this movie calls bullshit and nobody showed up. And so I was like sort of devastated, thinking to myself like, we're not going to have movie theaters very long if nobody's going to pay to go see movies. I feel the same way about newspapers.
Yeah.
And so for me, yeah, it has the nostalgia factor. It also has like, I basically said to a friend the other day, this is the Food Network show, but instead of food, it's newspapers. Like it's newspaper porn, where I watch this and I'm just like salivating, like, oh my gosh, I wanna get that full-sized, hot off the press, exciting headline newspaper, and I wanna like sit down and have coffee with it. Yeah. And it makes, you know, I mean, this is a movie that definitely like makes me like, I'm going to go out and subscribe to a newspaper. And I just loved it. I am also a big Samuel Fuller fan.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't mind it when contemporary directors just straight up steal from old directors. One, as long as they do it well. And two, as long as it's like a director that I love. And right. Spielberg, I mean, absolutely. He even includes a clip, I think, from a Samuel Fuller movie in the movie. And yeah. I the camera angles shifting to show the changes in the power relationships between people. The performances, I think Meryl Streep was really good in a role that I think pretty easily could have been missed and could have been, it was heavy handed, but it could have been more heavy handed than it was. And I think it was really saved by Meryl Streep's performance. I love this movie.
Yeah, and for me, what struck out in my mind with The Post is just the timing of it all. And I mean, these movies are, the production has started years ahead of time. And for this movie to come out right at
It
wasn't?
9 months. He said it was 9 months from the moment he read the script, submitted by a 31-year-old woman, I can't remember her name, but it was submitted, and he said, we have to make this right now, and there's no other year that this movie can be made.
All right, then. So there's that. I was going to say, the political side of things, definitely, especially freedom of the press, but also just the women in the workplace and how it deals with Meryl Streep as the publisher of the Washington Post. Okay, so it was timed a little bit more on Spielberg's part than I was giving him credit for originally, but he must have rearranged his entire schedule to do this. So.
Oh, he absolutely did, because he was making Ready Player One at the same time. Yep. So it was absolutely, and considering how high quality this is, given the Rush. Shortened. Yeah, that it's yeah. It's impressive.
Yeah, definitely.
So what are we on now? Are we on your number seven?
But mine was Get Out, so we already covered it. So what have you great. Got?
So I did Lady Bird.
Okay, so that's my number three.
And so this is, so I think at this point, we're now getting to the part of my list where if anybody picked any of these top seven as their number one, I would be totally fine with it. This, for me, was a very strong year in terms of the movies that came out. I enjoyed a lot of movies. Like you, I probably could have done a top 20 or a top 30 and been more comfortable than doing just a top 10. Lady Bird is another movie that I saw more than once in the movie theater, but I sort of had to. I showed up late to the first viewing and had to sit all the way in the far right corner, like 8 feet to the right of the edge of the screen. It was not conducive to a great viewing experience, but I went back and watched it a second time and a bunch of things jumped out at me. It's a perfectly written film. And in that, absolutely. I mean, there is not a word that is wasted. There is not a scene. There's not a sentence that doesn't echo later on in the movie. There isn't a scene that doesn't develop the people in the movie three or four different ways. This is a movie that talks about all the issues, you know, all the issues that are like the people face, not just in contemporary society, but just like in any society at any time.
Yeah.
But the great thing about the movie is while you're watching it and you're thinking, oh, this movie is about X, Y, and Z, at the end of the movie, and when I went back and watched it a second time, I realized it's also about A, B, and C, but you don't notice it until the very end, and then the cumulative effect sort of builds up to you. And that, to me, is the mark of an expert film writer, which is so impressive considering it's Greta Gerwig's first movie that she's written and directed.
Yeah. Yep. And similar to Jordan Peele, for this to be the first movie that they've written and directed and for them to be this good. And Lady Bird is, I can't really think of many other films that I've seen where I am invested in every single character's story on the screen. And that just speaks to the writing, as you said. And I wanted to spend more time with these characters when the movie ends. Like, I'm disappointed the movie's over because I want to see where else their stories are going, even though there's an ending to their story within this story. But they're just characters that every single one of them, to me, leapt off the screen. And it was that's what stuck with me the most after seeing it.
And there are a lot of movies that are very good movies that I picked that are higher than this that suffer from the flaw of, like, you see the character and immediately the character screams, I'm this character and this is why I'm important and these are my characteristics, blah, blah, blah. But with this movie, it's like, you know, there probably are a few characters like that, but the entire world is their people and it is the cumulative effect of their experiences and who they are that eventually you get to, like, okay, so these are who these people are. Nothing is being screamed at you. For most of the film, and that to me is really impressive, really subtle writing, and pitch perfect.
Yep, absolutely.
You know, it's interesting. A few movies this year that there's this great Japanese filmmaker that anybody that's really into art house film knows about, probably nobody else knows about, and that is I think it's Yoshijiro Ozu, the director Ozu from Japan, who did Tokyo Story in late spring.
Yep,
and just a very particular filmmaking style. And there are a bunch of movies this year. There were like three movies this year. After the Storm, which is not on any of my lists. And then another movie that I'm going to mention later. But then this film, directed by an American, like a thoroughly American director about a thoroughly American experience. And it feels like it's, you know, a nod to Ozu in that it's completely tight. Everything is controlled. Everything is subtle. And just really beautiful. And so I hope that Greta Gerwig makes 100 more movies after this.
You and I both.
So what is your number six?
My number six is The Florida Project.
Awesome.
Is that on your list? Or
It is not. That was a movie that was definitely on my list at one point, but we had to move it off to make space. So I'm excited to hear your take on it.
Yeah, and this is one that I just seen within the last week. So it was, for me, there were times when I was watching it where I almost forgot I was watching a scripted movie and it seemed like I was watching a documentary. I think it just zeroed in on, and it goes to the credit of the actors too. Their performances seem so real. And as great as Willem Dafoe is, I think part of it is when he's not on screen, it was a little easier to slip into that documentary feel because I had no experience with any of these actors. I assume this is probably some of their first acting that they've done.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I think the mother was discovered on Instagram.
Yeah.
And then the daughter, I think it's her first time acting.
Yeah. But just all of the kids in the movie, especially the mother and her best friend that is another mother of one of the kids, just a fascinating slice of life look at a situation that I honestly was totally ignorant of and had no idea that this is going on, which is that just a few miles outside of Disney World, there are these kind of rundown motels that people are living in and that they're paying rent and living in these hotels or motels and right alongside the happiest place on earth, and their experiences don't reflect that at all.
Oh, absolutely. No, absolutely. And I have a friend, we did a Five Trailers episode and he lived in that area and he said, really? Yeah, absolutely. And I think I've heard Sean Baker say like all of those places are real places. All of those motels are real motels. He didn't have to, you know, it's another low budget movie. He didn't have to do very much. He just basically drove up and was like, all right, this place, and this place.
Yeah.
Let's shoot him because this is magical.
Yep.
Yeah. Sorry, you go.
Oh, I was just going to say it's a movie that, again, stuck with me after I saw it, and I've just been thinking about it, kind of processing it still a week after I've seen it, and looking forward to seeing it again and seeing how the viewing experience changes after that initial viewing.
So for me, now I'm beginning to think I should have included this in my top 10. So first of all, I really like Sean Baker. He and I have been on the same podcast, the Criterion Now podcast, and he's just a very thoughtful. He's a fan of film, art house film, popular film. As a film nerd and a film lover and someone who secretly in the back of his head dreams and wishes that he could be making movies, to see somebody be successful that has that same passion and love and that same way is obviously very exciting. So I'm glad that he's getting all the accolades he's getting. The other thing that I got from watching this movie is as I was raised as a poor kid with poor parenting. And this movie captures, and everybody, whenever that's depicted, it's always the negative side that's depicted. This movie perfectly captures the magic of being a poorly parented child in that there is a lot of beauty. There's a lot of, living in these urban spaces where it's sort of, you know, now we look back and we're like, kids shouldn't be around that. That's sort of dangerous. But as a kid in that environment, it was exciting. It was fun. And, obviously there's tragedy in it and, you know, my personal stuff didn't get nearly as bad as some of the things that happened in this movie. I also didn't have that juxtaposition. I did not live immediately next door to extremely wealthy people and wealthy tourism, as a child. So I didn't have that weird, like, wait a second, why are these people living in this other world? But still, the fact that he was able to capture that very peculiar sort of magic from a child's perspective that doesn't have a ton, I think that's pretty awesome. And I gave Sean Baker, like, I was very emotionally engaged with it from that perspective. Definitely. I mean, I think I cried during the trailer for this movie.
Wow. Yeah. And it was such a combination of heart-wrenching and heartwarming that I can't think of another movie where I felt the same at sometimes in the same scene, let alone spread out throughout the whole movie.
So my number six, we already discussed Phantom Thread, just a terrific movie. So, so DJ, before we get to your number five, let's tell everybody what your honorable mentions are, the movies that, you know, would have made your top 20 or your top 30, but didn't quite cut it.
All right. Should I keep it to a certain number or just go through the list?
No, just say, you know, just let's do it. Give me one, give them all, whatever all you right. want to do.
I'll just run through them. So my honorable mentions were Call Me By Your Name, The Shape of Water, Star Wars The Last Jedi, Logan, Dunkirk, The Big Sick, Baby Driver, Brigsby Bear, and Logan Lucky.
I love it. I'm glad you mentioned Brigsby Bear. That's a tough movie for me because I watched that at Sundance and thought it was one of the best movies that had ever been made in the moment that I was watching it. But I think there's a part of me that sort of felt like it wasn't good. Like my experience was too singular and wasn't connected enough to the quality of the movie to mention it. But yeah. I have to say, like, I love that movie.
Yeah, go ahead.
I think it captures a nostalgia. I think particularly for people of a certain age. Yeah. Where it's like, that was a movie made made by someone my age and made for someone my age.
Yeah, and on top of that, it's also such a great story about creativity and the creative experience and just not only that, but being creative with your friends as well as, right. as being, yeah. So, and then I had not really honorable mentions, but I'm just going to go through it. They were movies I really enjoyed this year that wouldn't have made my best of list, but just stuff that and it's of course the kind of bigger budget Hollywood stuff, but just stuff that I really did enjoy, which was Guardians of the Galaxy 2, Thor Ragnarok, Spider-Man Homecoming, Wonder Woman, Trainspotting 2, and War for the Planet of the Apes. So
I love it. So I also have Call Me By Your Name as an honorable mention, and that was a really close thing. Call Me By Your Name has two of the most beautiful scenes in movie history. In it, I mean, there was one scene where it's just the way that they set up the movement of the two characters walking around this monument.
Yes,
where I'm watching it and my brain, like, I was sort of appreciating the film up until that point, and my neck snapped where I thought, "Whoa, what is this?" Yeah, and there are other parts of the movie that are just so beautiful. And gosh, that there is one conversation between a parent and a child yeah. where at the end of the movie, I literally looked at strangers and said, I don't buy it. That there's no parent in the history of parenting that is that great.
Yeah.
So just a beautiful film, and, you know, it probably would have been on my top 10 list. It would probably be on it yesterday, probably be on it tomorrow. Also, another movie like that, the movie I had ranked very highly at one point was The Square. Again, that's a movie that I could have put in my top. You know, I could have put in my top four.
Yeah.
The Florida Project, again, a movie that probably should have been on there. The Lure, Disaster Artist, was perhaps the funniest movie I've seen in the movie theater ever. I laughed so hard. I watched a little bit of The Room before I watched it, but. Definitely you should watch the two together. Thor Ragnarok. We talked about Mother and the fact that we're sort of shocked and grateful that Mother was ever made. Another yeah. movie like that is Blade Runner 2049.
That's on my list, so we'll get to that.
And then I really love the first two-thirds of Logan.
Yeah.
The first two-thirds of Logan would have been in my top 10. if it weren't for the last third, it would have been in my top 10. And then what were you going
to
say?
I still have to watch the black and white version of it, which has been sitting next to my TV since it came out on Blu-ray. And I meant to watch it right away and never got to it. So I'm looking forward to seeing Mangold's black and white version.
The last movie, and this movie I almost dropped off Get Out to put this on, is Nocturama, which is available on Netflix. And this is, oh gosh, I don't even know how to describe it. I think the way to describe it is to say that if movie Kids had been made about terrorists instead of HIV, it would have been this film. It's just as weird as what I'm describing, but it is a movie that I watched it last night and I just haven't stopped thinking about. Absolutely haunting. So definitely check out Nocturama if you get a chance.
Yep, that's going on the list too.
So now we can get back into the top five. We're racing to number one with a bullet. DJ, what's your number five?
My number five is Wind River, which was, it was Taylor Sheridan's, it's not his directorial debut. There was a little controversy about this. It seems like he directed, I think, a horror movie early on in his career, which kind of disappeared from IMDb, and this was kind of marketed as his directorial debut.
Interesting.
And he wrote Hell or High Water, which was my top 10 last year. He wrote Sicario. And then Wind River was written and directed by him. And for me, it was, I think from some of the stuff I've read about it, it seems very well reviewed, but some critics seem to have issues with some tonal shifts in the movie and just the message delivery. But I didn't fall into that category. I thought it was a really strong film. And one thing that stuck out is, I think anybody who's seen Sicario probably remembers the scene where they're trying to cross the border and come back into the US. And the tension that builds up over that, which the director, which I'm going to butcher his name because it's been years since I've spoke French, but Denis Villeneuve, I think he was given a lot of credit for how that scene plays out. But there's at least one scene in Wind River where I think Taylor Sheridan proves that not only can he write an extremely suspenseful scene, but he also knows how to direct one as well. And it's, have you seen it?
I have seen Wind River.
Okay.
I did not put it. It is not one of my favorite movies of the year. I thought the action sequences, particularly anytime he's on a snowmobile, very well shot.
Yeah.
And I think there's one sequence in particular, which I will not describe, like when they finally sort of show the mystery, the answer to the mystery.
Yep.
It is extremely well done, how they shift into it and the way that it's depicted. But I probably am with the critics in that I thought that the aspects where they talk about Native American history were really, like, felt really forced to me.
Okay.
And that might be something where other people don't feel that, but to me it definitely felt it took me out of the movie whenever it came up. I was like, okay, so now he's doing this. And so that was a movie that I was excited to see because it had some buzz from Sundance, which I went to last year. And in fact, I had a midnight ticket to go see it, but I was too tired after all day watching movies.
Movies, yeah.
Yeah, poor me. But no, after, like, I didn't get to go see it, and so I was looking forward to seeing it for a while, and it did not live up to my expectations, but perhaps that's just my fault for having expectations. Did that sound smug? That was not supposed.
No.
It is really hard for me not to sound snarky.
No, I think that's why we're doing this list, to see how they how they differ. I also thought it was honestly a masterful performance from Jeremy Renner. I know he got a lot of buzz for the Hurt Locker, and then, well, he got nominated, and then he got nominated again for The Town. But I think this is above and beyond what I've seen him do before, and because so much of the performance is done with facial expressions and just body language, and it's something that I don't think I'd given him credit prior to this to being as good an actor as I thought he proved to be with this performance.
Yeah, he certainly is making a bid for the action star with emotional depth. Like to have him be that guy in all the movies. I think for me the jury's out on Renner. I really like his performance in Avengers Age of Ultron, where he's sort of making fun of his role in the Avengers. Yeah. I thought that was my favorite Jeremy Renner performance. I kind of like him in The Town now that I think about it. His Boston accent is completely incomprehensible.
Yeah. I loved him in The Town. I thought he was better in The Town than he was in The Hurt Locker.
I think he's really good in The Town too, even though I genuinely can't understand half the words he says. It's like, I'm from Boston. I have a Boston accent, as I'm told all the time, but I just can't understand it. But no, I think I am on the side of liking Renner, and I don't think it was enough for me for Wind River. And that was a disappointment. It was a movie that I was primed to like and didn't end up liking. So for my number five is the movie. This movie I saw at the end of the summer. I don't know if it just had like a really bad release date or if it didn't get enough marketing, but this movie absolutely bombed. And I think that there's really, like, I think that is a discredit to audiences everywhere that we allowed this movie to come out and we didn't go see it in droves. And that is the Safdie Brothers' Good Time.
Hey, I just watched that the other night.
What did you think of it?
I liked it. Actually, I don't know why I didn't have that on my honorable mention. It should have been on that list. Yeah. I thought this was a great year for Robert Pattinson, proving that he is a much better actor than the Twilight movies would ever show, between this and the Lost City of Zed or Lost City of Z, depending on where you're from.
Yeah, no, I totally agree. I think it's a great performance. So this movie, I have joked. I think the joke goes something like, I've never smoked crack cocaine, but I imagine if I had, it would be a little bit like this movie. Okay. Both in terms of the experience of watching the movie, and I think just overall the plot of the movie, like, comes off as, oh, this movie would make a lot of sense if everybody was just smoking crack the whole time. Yeah. Large portions of the movie is shot like the opening sequence in Belly, which, you know, so one right there, that's amazing. And then the plot is intentionally reminiscent of or derivative of Scorsese's After Hours. Okay. Mm-hmm. So two big attributes to its credit. It's one of the most intense movies of the year. The trend recently has been about more synth heavy scores, I think, influenced by Stranger Things. And this absolutely has, you know, one of the best synth scores you could imagine. Yeah. I absolutely love it, the way it's shot, the way that it's the soundtrack works. Mm-hmm. The heart of it is the story of the two brothers, one played by Robert Pattinson, the other played by one of the co-directors, as a mentally limited or disabled brother who sort of becomes the motivator for all the action. And Pattinson is basically just makes, with good intentions, makes one bad decision after another, and all of the bad decisions he makes are totally understandable, and the tension, the movie starts with incredible tension and never lets go. I think it's pretty wonderful. And then I also like how in this movie, it also has the political aspect, because it's like, this is toxic, white, male privilege, but from like the lower class version.
Yeah.
And as you see through the movie, as he's making all these decisions, other people are suffering, and you often see that the people that are suffering are women, are people of color, and it's, you know, it's really tough to watch this guy who your heart's sort of rooting for him, but you just see him like destroy lives all the way through
the aftermath in his wake.
Yeah. I love this movie. It's poignant. It's so tense, so action packed. Times it's extremely funny. I'm a big fan of Good Time.
Nice.
So what is your next movie? Your number four.
My number four is Blade Runner 2049.
Great.
And this was a movie that as I was watching it, I was so impressed with the fact that they were doing this very detailed world building on a world or in a world that is already famous for the world building that was done 30 plus years ago. And just some of the effects that were just tiny little aspects of what was going on in the movie, but were done so well. And it was so impressive. And it was almost just a throwaway effect. It was just something that Ryan Gosling looked at one point, but, and then there's the, well, it's been out for long enough where I don't know that this is really spoilerish, but there's a great scene where Gosling and Ford are fighting, and there's these holograms being projected of, I think, Elvis, I think Marilyn Monroe pops up, and it's kind of this whole fight scene going on with these holograms around, and it was, I was just blown away by the world building, the attention to detail, and the fact that they made a sequel to Blade Runner so long after the original, the fact that they made a sequel at all, and it is, they pulled it off. I mean, I thought it was a great film, and like the original, has a lot to say about what it means to be human.
I read Infinite Jest, and I've read some other stuff by David Foster Wallace. This is a movie where I think it's too bad that David Foster Wallace isn't still alive, because he would just be blown away by the movie. One of the things that I think the movie... I think you're right. The fact that the movie advances those questions of what it's like to be human. One of the big questions that philosophers and literature and art has to address right now is, who are we in terms of social media? Who are we in terms of the technology that is surrounding us and is being absorbed into us? Black Mirror is constantly doing episodes about this.
Yep.
And this movie does a very thoughtful, very human and emotional connection to those questions. It isn't just, you know, let's mess with your head. It's
right.
Let's confuse your heart. Let's take you out of your comfort zone and say, why are we developing these relationships to the technical things in our lives, perhaps to the detriment of the people in our lives? You know, I mean, you and I right now are recording a podcast. So, yeah. So this is certainly something that echoes with all of us, is as our connections potentially decrease with real humans and we increase our connections with virtual humanity, like what happens with that? And that's something that I think they do a really good job of in this movie.
Yeah, and to its credit, it doesn't do anything to take away from the mystery and the questions of the first one.
Oh, extremely, extremely respectful of the first one, even as it goes off in many other directions as well.
Yeah. So that was definitely, and I knew as I, well, not as I was watching it, but once I finished it, I was pretty confident that that would end up in my top five of the year, and in the end, it did. So
there's a part of me that you just have to be grateful that this movie exists. They clearly gave Ridley Scott and Denis Villeneuve like carte blanche to make this movie, because there's no way a studio would see the final cut of this and be like, okay, yeah, no, well, let's do a 2.5 hour. Let's make a sequel to a movie that bombed in the first place. Let's do a longer, slower version of it, and let's remove all of the action.
Yeah.
What do you guys think about that? And I can absolutely see all of the executives at Sony being like, absolutely, let's make a $150 million version of Stalker. Yeah. It's like, it's a sleepy movie. It's a sleepy, it is, yep, slow cinema, a blockbuster.
Yep.
And that to me alone means that it's an important film, even though I didn't put it in my top 10. It's, you know, it's a big movie, and it's a miracle that it got made, and I'm glad that it did. So, my number four is a much smaller movie, a movie called Columbus. So this is a movie that was another Sundance darling, and when I saw the description of it and the, you know, the picture of it, I thought, there's no way on earth I want to see that. It's a movie starring John Cho, and he, And I actually don't remember the actress's name, although she co-stars in it and is wonderful in it as well. And but it's this movie about these two people going through transitions in their lives, particularly around family and around their parents. And it's set in Columbus, Indiana, not Columbus, Ohio. It's Columbus, Indiana. And Columbus, Indiana, fairly randomly, is a mecca for modernist architecture. And it is a meditation on family. It's a meditation on loss. It's a meditation on art and how art impacts our lives. And it is all. It is another homage to the great Japanese director Ozu. And these are all things that I love about it. But that doesn't really capture what Koganada did in this film. It just, within about 15 minutes of the movie, very quiet moments brought me to tears. And I just found this movie to be bizarrely effective on me and bizarrely moving. I wasn't expecting it, and I still can't fully explain why it hypnotized me the way it did. But first of all, I think John Cho ought to be sending Koganada a letter every year thanking him for making this movie. Because John Cho, as far as I'm concerned, is a sex symbol now. And I think following John Cho on Twitter, I think he agrees with that. Not that it made him a sex symbol, but that he, you know, this is the sort of movie that any actor would want to make, but particularly the limited roles that I think Asian American actors get in American films. I think he was glad to have something a lot meatier and a lot more substantial than some of the stuff that has been out there. And Koganada, first time director. I mean, this is just a year for amazing directorial debuts. And I hope that Koganada makes 100 more movies. Just absolutely love it.
I'm going to come out of this list with a top 10 list of movies I need to see right away. So this is great. Because I've seen, when you first said the name, it didn't register. But then as you described it, I do remember seeing a trailer for it. And it was, I think I meant to put it on a list to see, and then I don't even remember seeing it playing anywhere around here, but I will definitely get to that one too.
So we already discussed your number three and your number two. Can you remind us what those were?
My number three was Lady Bird. My number two was The Post.
And is there anything else we should say about either one of those movies that we didn't discuss?
No, I think we covered both of them pretty well.
Both great movies. Were you surprised? Did you go into The Post thinking like did you go into it thinking I'm going to love this movie, or did you go into it with as much sort of skepticism as I had?
I was probably somewhere in the middle. I'm a massive Spielberg fan, and but I don't go into every one of his movies thinking I am going to love this. I went into the BFG with some reservations and came out loving that one. But that's a not that I'm comparing the BFG and The Post, but I went in with hopes that I would like it. I liked Bridge of Spies a lot. I liked Lincoln. So as this was kind of completing that official, unofficial civics trilogy, I don't think I expected to like it. I didn't expect it to be my number two. I wasn't expecting it to be in my top five. I figured it would probably land somewhere in the top 10 just because Spielberg and what I'd heard. But I was pleasantly surprised with how much I did enjoy it. And I was telling my wife that she had wanted to see it, but we couldn't find the time to go together before recording this. And I had to see it before this, but I told her we're going to go see this cause you need to see it. So, it's something that I will be seeing again in the theater.
Yeah. It's a great film. And, I was definitely glad that I sort of dragged myself to go see it, and I'm extremely glad that I did. And I think I'm going to have to, I just have all these hangups about the movies that I'm going to go see, and I really need to get rid of them. So number three, and this is, you know, talk about a good segue. This is a movie that, my number three selection is the movie Raw. It's available on Netflix for people that didn't get to see it in the movie theaters, so definitely go check it out. This was a movie that had a lot of buzz out of Sundance as well. And but I just thought, how on earth am I going to connect with a female coming of age story about a cannibal. I just thought, like,
I'm sure you're not the only one thinking that.
I just thought there's no way that I'm going to want to, like, I'm going to enjoy watching that movie. And I was just so wrong. And I'm glad that so many people at Sundance told me that I had to go see it. Again, it's Julia DeCornau's debut film, Franco-Belgian production, absolutely beautifully shot. Some more, this isn't even modern architecture. This is brutalism. You and I, having gone to UMass together, we are painfully familiar with brutalism, particularly in the college context, and that is where the movie is shot. And so it has that going along with it. But the heart of this movie is, it's a coming-of-age story where all of the crazy things that happen as you're going through puberty, or like late puberty, as you're going into the world and becoming an adult and exploring, you know, some of the darker sides of what it means to be an adult, heavy drinking, sex, all of that stuff. It punctuates all of those experiences with body horror. And it works. For me, it works so much because the body horror and the horror that's in the film isn't just, oh, well, we're going to give you a scare. It's, I want you to experience the true terror that this character must be experiencing from the horror that we're depicting on the film, so that it's the horror is like very specific notes that are supposed to be struck at exactly the right time for the character's development. And I just think it works.
Yeah, and this was one I haven't seen. It's been on my list to see, and I was a little hesitant because, I mean, usually gore doesn't bother me at all, but I'd heard this one you kind of have to prepare yourself for for what you're going to see.
It's cringe horror as well. Like, I was in the movie theater here in Boston watching it, and there was nobody in the seat in front of me, and I'm glad for that because I was squeezing the seat in front of me.
Yeah.
Like squealing with like cringe, terror, excitement, whatever. It was just a wonderful film. A lot of movies that I have on my list are movies that came out at the beginning of 2017, in those months where people think usually they dump the terrible films. And I think that's just another lesson. Like, you know, sort of we should all when we go see movies, or I should at least, I need to set aside my expectations about what a movie's going to be and just, you know, sort of go into these things blind and not think, oh, well, it's a movie about this and it's coming out in this month, so it can't be good. It's just like go in and experience it and experience the surprise. That's half the fun.
Yeah. So your number two?
My number two. This is another 413 connection, another connection to Amherst in Western Massachusetts, and this is Terrence Davies' A Quiet Passion. Have you seen the movie?
Another one I haven't seen.
So this is Cynthia Nixon basically fought to play Emily Dickinson in Terrence Davies' movies. Terrence Davies certainly is one of those people that is making an argument for the best living director, whereas PTA and Aronofsky are younger guys, and some of their best work is behind them. This is like an older guy, and his best work is in front of him, I think. Terrence Davies is a British director, a gay director who is making movies about the gay, you know, his experience as a gay man. Back when that may have been a lot more controversial than it would be if somebody put out a movie like that now. And just everything he makes is lyrical and magical, and this movie is no exception. And, you know, it's a movie that doesn't play down to the audience or give any, like, faux psychology, like, where does her brilliance come from? But instead focuses sort of on the beauty and the pain of what it would have been like to be a woman, albeit like an upper class woman, but being a woman in 19th century America, and you know, death certainly being a part of that, and like physical pain. And it just, by the end of the movie, I was just, even though I don't think that there was anything traditionally manipulative or melodramatic about this movie, I was just absolutely shaken, and nobody left that movie theater after seeing A Quiet Passion until about 10 minutes after the last shot. Because everybody was so was so shook from the film. I actually ran into friends of mine afterwards, and I had to apologize to them. Like, hey, just to let you know, I saw a very sad movie, and that's why I'm a mess. I'm not actually a mess as a person. It's just the movie I just saw.
I'm so. Okay. I'm just not okay right now.
Yeah, just a really wonderful film, and you know, I'm so excited. Terrence Davies, he came to Harvard in the Harvard Film Archive, and I saw his, I think it's Sunset Song, and he did a little question and answer afterwards, and he said, yeah, and I have two more movies coming out. I had two movies released this year in America. He said, I'm in danger of becoming prolific, you know, which is just, we are all so lucky that is the case. This is this guy's an international treasure, and I'm looking forward to seeing more of his movies that I haven't seen.
Well, that one's going on my list too.
All right, so we are at number one. So I guess let's take a step back and let's talk about some of the movies we haven't seen before we get into our number one pick of the year. What are some of the movies that you haven't seen that you are like, oh, I definitely have to check these out?
Number one is The Disaster Artist.
Have you seen The Room?
So I have not seen The Room because I don't think I can make it through. I've seen probably half an hour of it.
Okay, so you get the ways that the movie is wrong if you've seen half an hour of it.
Oh yeah, and I just don't know that I can submit myself to seeing that. But The Disaster Artist has been on my list, and it's just one I didn't make it to. Along with that, I didn't see All the Money in the World. I wanted to see that one. I haven't seen Detroit. Mudbound, Raw, The Darkest Hour, Battle of the Sexes, Downsizing, Hostels, Last Flag Flying, The Lure, and Personal Shopper. Those were the ones that I had wanted to get to and didn't.
So besides Raw, the movie that you listed there that I would say like, oh, you have to go run out and see. So Raw and Disaster Artist, both great movies. But I think you should also definitely try to get out and see The Lure.
Yeah, it's the Criterion Blu-ray awesome. Sitting next to my TV right now. So,
oh, it's a gorgeous movie. It's such a bizarre genre mashup that it has to be seen to believe. And I totally loved it. As one person described it, he said it was when he was watching it, it was the best movie that was ever made.
Wow. All right.
So it's really fun. I'm looking forward to hearing your take on it.
Did I say Maudie? I don't know if I said it, but it's on my list.
Yeah, that's a movie that a lot of people have really enjoyed. I also haven't seen it. Sally Hawkins, I saw her in Shape of Water, and she is an actress that I hadn't really thought that much about before, and now clearly she's on my radar, and I need to check out more by her.
Yeah.
Mudbound is absolutely a movie that I haven't seen, and there are a bunch of movies that came out at Sundance that I just haven't gotten around to seeing yet, which is just embarrassing because it's, you know, things that are on your radar at the beginning of the year shouldn't go unseen 12 months later. But Big Sick also falls into that category. There are a few movies that I really want to see that just haven't really been widely available in Boston yet. So Faces, Places, Ex Libris by Wiseman. Zama, I don't know if that's come out anywhere in the U.S., but that's by, I think it's Lucretia Martel is the name of the director. She did La Cienega, and that's one of my favorite movies. And any movie that she comes out with, I'm going to have to check out. And Thelma, Other Side of Hope,
oh, yeah.
BPM, Wonderstruck. I have a good friend who Wonderstruck was, one of the movies he wanted to see the most this year, and I was supposed to go out and see it, just never got around to it. It's just so many movies, so little time. Right, DJ?
Yep, exactly.
But there is a movie that both you and I saw. And
there is.
And we both picked it as our favorite movie of the year. Why don't you say what our mutual favorite movie is of 2017, DJ, for number one?
Three Billboards Outside Ebbing, Missouri.
I love it. So I think before you and I go in and have a gush fest over this movie, which we're going to have because it is also my number one movie, and I have so many positive things to say about it, Why don't you have you seen any of the controversy around this film? Can you sort of make the argument for people that don't like this movie?
I could understand why people don't like it. I think it's a hard movie to like. But I mean, I can understand if some of the subject matter is just too much for people. I read one review the other day that was kind of a takedown of it, and that they don't as great as aspects of it are, they don't think it really delivers.
Yep.
And I couldn't see that point of view really. I'm too big a fan of Martin McDonagh maybe to not I guess try and connect with what the writer was trying to say in that review. But
you and me both. I think to be blunt about it, I think that there are people, when you think of a movie written and directed by a white man about race and about misogyny in America, I think the first thing that comes to mind is Crash.
Yeah.
And so, you know, and so you think like, oh, this is going to be, it's going to be 1 centimeter deep. It's going to be trite, and it's going to be, even though it's trying to be politically correct, it's going to be offensive. And by the way, this is a movie that in no way, shape, or form tries to be politically correct.
Nah, McDonagh never does.
And this is, you know, and this is perhaps a time where, you know, there are some people that have suggested if he had known the context of when the movie would be released, maybe he would have changed a few things. I actually don't think he would have.
No, I don't think so either.
And I don't think he's Lars von Trier or Michael Haneke. I don't think he's trying to be intentionally provocative. I mean, maybe a little bit, but I don't think that he ever, like, that's the goal, and structure and plot and all of that is, like, secondary. I think this is just a movie that talks about provocative things, and he's a guy who's like, we're just gonna lay it out on the table. And I think a lot of people feel like he was wrong. I'm not one of those people, but they feel like he got that wrong. He got the tone wrong in certain instances.
Yeah, I'm not one of those people either, obviously.
So let's start the gush fest. What is there to love about Three Billboards Outside of Ebbing, Missouri?
I don't know where to start, so I guess I'll start with Martin McDonagh and his screenplay. I was an instant fan of him when I first saw In Bruges in the theater, and I saw Seven Psychopaths. I've gone and gotten some of his plays and read some of his plays. Would love to see one of his plays performed the next time there's an opportunity to do that. Hopefully we'll be able to. So I just love his writing. I love his characters, his dialogue. And on top of that, I love the fact that he reuses a lot of the same actors. So Sam Rockwell was in Seven Psychopaths. He's been in at least one of his plays. And you see that from In Bruges right through Three Billboards. You'll see the same actors popping up throughout his three films that he's done so far. Woody Harrelson, again, he was in Seven Psychopaths as well. And for me, it was the performances as well. I mean, Frances McDormand and Sam Rockwell are two of the best performances of the year, but also two of the best performances I've seen in years, I'd say.
Yeah, I'm right there with you. Martin McDonagh. So I'm a big theater guy, and the theater that I frequent the most, the GAM Theater in Rhode Island, they have done all of the McDonagh plays, I think, except for Hangmen, the new one.
Okay, the new one, yep.
And so I'm predisposed to liking films made by really great theater directors and theater writers. And the other thing I'm a huge fan of is I'm a fan of sharp, edgy dialogue. I don't even want to say edgy. Let's just remove the edgy part. I'm a fan of sharp, witty, like rapid fire fireworks type dialogue, and that this movie delivers on that front in so many different ways.
Yep.
I also think in terms of what the what the underlying message of the, and this is not like a message movie, because I think McDonough probably actively avoids, you know, being optimistic or pessimistic in any of his films. I think he tries to leave mm-hmm. it always ambiguous, whether we should be optimists or pessimists. But in terms of some of the stuff that he wants to dredge out and really like discuss, and some of the nasty things that we don't get to talk about that often, are things that were really bothering me when this movie, when I saw this movie. Watching this movie felt like lancing a boil. It felt like I was watching the people in my life that I was angry at, politically, or just like interpersonal relationships, and it was done in a way that was never, it never felt, it was always didactic, but it never felt like heavy-handed. It never felt like it was talking down to anybody. And it clearly has a perspective. Racism is wrong. You know, like the movie clearly it plays in the appropriate moral universe. But mm-hmm. also at the same time, it's like, but these are still humans. And here's some of the fear and anger that comes with these people that have these reprehensible political views or that are doing these reprehensible acts. And here's why. And that for me was so profound. And I found it to be very moving. I still disagree with all of that stuff. But I am constantly looking to empathize with the other, whether it's the other that I like and admire or whether it's the other that I sort of loathe. If you can do that magic trick of making me understand other people's perspective, you get major John Lobinger points for your movie. And that this movie did that for me.
Yeah, it was. I mean, have you seen it multiple times or just the one?
I have not. I have the script and I haven't reread it, but it was such a visceral reaction. You and I could probably sit here and go through scene by scene how the movie operates from my one viewing.
I feel the same way. I do want to go see it again, but I'm glad that there'll be, by the time I see it again, it'll probably be 2 months since I first saw it, so I'm glad there'll be some time in between. But it's one that easily, I think, takes the number one spot for me. And I said that after I saw it, and I didn't expect anything else to come up after that was going to steal it away. And there hasn't been. It's number one with a bullet for sure.
You know, when everybody talks about the race and misogyny and domestic violence and just the violence overall that are themes of this movie and are major components of this movie, the things that I think the people don't talk enough about is one, this sort of this death of the great white male. The myth of the great white male, the John Wayne character. This movie deals with that like head on, and I think it is just wonderful. It's moving, it's empathetic, but it's also like, this is real, and it happened, and like, let's deal with it and let's move on. And I thought that was like kind of an awesome thing to show in a movie. I think another thing that people don't talk enough about is McDonough, I think, it explores a lot of spiritual stuff in his movies, and you're so like wrapped up in, you know, the dialogue and the action and the over the top things that happen in the movie, the performances, you don't think about the quieter moments in the film, and this movie definitely has that. And so, you know, any director that can come in and do, you know, joke after joke after joke after tragedy after tragedy after tragedy, and then, you know, punctuate it with like, what's the meaning of life? I'm sorry. I feel like that's a magic trick that we, you know, you have to stand up and applaud after you see that in a movie theater.
Yeah, definitely.
So, wow, look at that. Same number one. We're in agreement. Great movies this year. What are some of your 2018 things that you're looking forward to, or some of your film specific 2018 New Year's resolutions?
Let's go with what I'm looking forward to, which I think we touched on a little bit in our last episode, just from the trailers we talked about. So Black Panther and Avengers Infinity War are two of the ones I'm really looking forward to. I'm trying to think. Let me open up my list here.
Did you? One of the things that I'm looking forward in 2018, and this is so weird to look forward to a remake, but did you see the director of Call Me By Your Name is directing a Suspiria remake?
I have not seen that, but that'll go on the list.
Yeah, and it's starring. Oh, I'm gonna actually have to look this up, and this is not good podcast behavior, but it's so amazing. I want to get this right. The people that are going to be in it. Yeah, so it has Dakota Johnson, Chloe Grace Moretz, and Tilda Swinton.
Oh, wow. That's coming out 2018?
That's coming out in 2018, absolutely.
Wow.
So we have that to look forward to.
Yeah. Ready Player One, of course, because it's Spielberg.
Can't wait.
I'm looking forward to the Han Solo movie in just that I want to see how it works, if it works at all, or if it's just a disaster, especially after all the behind-the-scenes drama.
I would love it if Disney gets spanked for all of the behind-the-scenes drama. I don't like the idea of corporate filmmaking and messing with directors. Yeah. So I would love it. There's a part of me that would love it to be the only movie they lose money on, just to get them to stop doing that.
Yeah. What else have I got? Wes Anderson has an animated movie coming out.
Isle of the Dogs. Yes.
Yeah. It's right now. It's just kind of the stuff that I know is in production and has had a trailer or the bigger movies. So I haven't seen much of the smaller independent stuff, what to look forward to or what's going to come out of the festivals.
So my 2018 resolution in terms of films is to go see more film festivals. I was lucky enough to go to Sundance last year. I'm going to be going again this year. And I also went to Bergman Island. I went to Föda, Sweden, spelled F-A-R-O, in Sweden. And I went to Bergman Fest. And this is his 100th anniversary of his birth.
That's right.
So I'm going to go back. But I also want to see even more films and festivals. Definitely want to go check out the Toronto Film Festival and some of the stuff in New York, like Tribeca and the New York Film Festival. So that is my 2018 resolution.
Nice.
So, DJ, another resolution is to get to have more conversations with you about movies.
Sounds good to me.
2017 was a heck of a year. Terrific for movies, if perhaps for nothing else. And let's hope that 2018 is just as good film-wise.
I hope so. We'll see.
Either way, we'll certainly be back here talking about it on Film Baby Film. And, DJ, I'm hoping that you'll come back and we'll be able to apprise everybody of our 2018 picks before you know
it. Anytime.
DJ, thanks so much for coming on.
Thank you.